minute 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and I'm here with my assistant,
Sinead Willihan. Hi. Happy to be here. Hello, everybody. Thanks so much, Grant, for having me here. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm looking forward to learning from Michael Grosso.
Yeah, Michael, we had, as you know, we had a conversation with Victoria. I had contact in the desert. And this is like the Super Bowl of all paranormal conferences. And she heard that I had a podcast and a YouTube channel. So she said, oh, would you like to interview some of the speakers? You can pick whichever one you want. We'll help you set them up. And I go, well, thank you, Jesus. I mean, holy cow, I couldn't believe it. So we picked a bunch of speakers. And one of the ones we have today is Michael Grosso, who I've listened to a lot of his stuff. He's sort of in the field with Sinead and I, in terms of, we may not have the highest audience in terms of the people who do the evil alien stuff or the conspiracy stuff, but I think Michael is on the track of what this thing's all about. He's sort of figured it out, and I applaud him for that. He taught philosophy and the humanities at Kennedy University, City University of New York, and New Jersey City University. He's on the board of directors of the American Philosophical Practitioners Association. He is the author of 5 books, maybe more than that now. Michael studied classics and received his PhD in philosophy from Columbia University. He has taught philosophy and humanities at various universities. Some of his books include Smile of the Universe, Miracles in the Age of Disbelief, The Man Who Could Fly, St. Joseph of Carpentino, and the Mystery of Levitation, The Final Choice, Death or Transition, Experiencing the Next World Now. Michael's focus is on the science of the extraordinary human experience and the creative implications of altered states of consciousness. Now, he's going to be lecturing at Contact in the Desert, and his lecture there is going to be called Supernatural, Nurturing Our Miraculous Potential and Extraordinary Abilities. So welcome, Michael. I'm honored to have a chance to talk to you after hearing all the very weird stories that you tell in your various books and lectures, and I'm honored to have you on.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Wow. Let me start with the first question, then we'll go to Sinead. I noticed in looking at your bio that you are on the board of the Consciousness and Contact Research Institute. And when it first started out, I don't know if you know the synchronicity, Ray Hernandez, who sort of was at the beginning of that whole thing, had his experience with the dog. Well, that happened like within a week of my experience of consciousness experience, where I left the presidents, I left all the nuts and bolts stuff, and sort of went into this world of studying consciousness, because I was basically told that's what this is about. It's about consciousness. And so Ray had that. And then 2 days before he had the experience with the contact modalities, I met with him in Florida. I was giving a lecture on consciousness, and it was a couple of days later, he had this very dramatic out-of-body experience where he gets shown the contact modality. So you're on the board now. Can you talk about the Consciousness and Contact Research Institute, why it's important, what they're doing? Because I think this is some of the most important work, even though I think a lot of people really don't pay attention to this. They have done some major studies on experiencers and looked at the patterns. And I think they've caught on, like you and I, what's actually important in this whole mystery.
Yeah, well, when I met Ray, he called me out of the blue. Well, first I received a copy of the book Beyond UFOs. And I don't know who sent it to me, but I started reading it. And then soon after I got a call out of the blue from Ray. And we had an astonishing conversation, swapping tales of extraordinary events. And he told me about this healing dog experience in which some kind of energy entity entered into his house. And then his wife and the dog disappeared.
Yeah.
And then when they came back, when they reappeared, the dog was healed. I mean, this was a completely mind-blowing experience. And I immediately took to Ray. And, you know, I hear a lot of stories from people. I don't believe everything I hear. and this guy convinced me. I mean, you know, he's a lawyer. Really impressed me. And so we immediately bonded, and I told him my story, which took place actually in 1971, 5 days before I was going to get my PhD at Columbia University in philosophy. And I gave him the interpretation that the reason I had my experience at that moment in my life, the way I construed it was some kind of a message from where I know not, but the message was, oh, you are now a doctor. Doctor in Latin means wise. So you think you're wise? Figure this out, buddy. that was the sense that I had after the experience was over. And so at any rate, Ray and I, since that time, have been pretty close and exchanged all kinds of ideas. But what I was working on a book. My main interest has been on just parapsychology in general and its implications for religion. At the same time, I see, and this is in response to your question, I think what Ray is doing that's very important is emphasizing the need to combine parapsychology and ufology. Both of those fields, I mean, I know folks from both areas, and they don't know each other. The ufologists stay away from the parapsychologists, and my smart parapsychological friends don't talk too much about the ufology. But I think that's a mistake. As a matter of fact, that was one of the reasons why I felt such a rapport with Ray on this that we really need. I mean, first of all, you have reports of levitation in many UFO experiences. I've written two books on the subject, and it's a deep part of religious experience. On the other hand, it also occurs in non-religious contexts, and there are all kinds of stories I can talk about that. And of course, telepathy is a big thing in the UFO experience, in the abduction and the contact experiences. Of course, the whole history of this subject has been evolving, as I'm sure you know. It started out in certain ways, and things have changed. And one of the things that really baffles me is the almost infinite variety of entities that presumably are aliens. I mean, they've come in all kinds of varieties, and there's a whole history to that I've been reviewing. So I'm really baffled. I'm baffled by the whole thing, needless to say. But I think that this project working with Ray is an important step forward to combine. But I would add, from my perspective, I would say it's a tripartite challenge we have here to see the connections between parapsychology, ufology, and religion. Because again, I mean, I just read an account of one group of aliens that call themselves the angels of the earth. I've forgotten exactly what group that was. And that's a really interesting notion. Angels are religious concepts, right? And they've been showing up and manifesting in all manner of, you know, ways throughout history. So anyway, I do think we're on a new phase of this research, And a lot of my friends in parapsychology, like Dean Radin, for example, he's involved. Ken Ring, of course. The only reason Ray got in touch with me was because Ken Ring, in his last book, the last book he wrote on the near-death experience, was also about alien abductions. And it was the first book that I saw that was on that. Now, Ken was a very good friend of mine at that time, and he quotes me at length in the book. And I think that's the reason that I got drawn into this. And I'm very happy about it, because I feel as though it's a kind of challenge to really get to the to a point where we can begin to think about making these connections in a new way and bring in more people, as many as we can, to work on this enormous mind-boggling challenge of encountering these extraordinary phenomena and extraordinary experiences that people are having. And at the same time, right now, I'm additionally very excited about the fact that since 2017, the mainstream culture and the government itself is beginning to open up about the reality of UFOs. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of that. I mean,
Yeah, right.
And the other benign things that seem to be happening that are opening up at this moment, scientists for the past couple of decades have finally begun to wake up and realize that animals are conscious. I think animal consciousness is another area that has been sort of hidden. And I mean, I think it's shocking when you think about so many scientists have never occurred to them to ponder the mystery of our fellow living creatures and their consciousness. That goes back to Descartes, maybe, who sort of laid it out that animals were just robot-like machines. So, and there's also a breaking and opening up in terms of the, as for consciousness, the legalization. In fact, I live in Virginia. July 1st, marijuana is going to be legal. Now, you may say, well, why? What does that have to do with anything? Well, first of all, the government has been lying about marijuana for decades. Now they're coming out. I'm finding in supermarkets, magazines, and little books talking about the benefits, the health benefits of marijuana. So I'm for that, but I'm also for the health of consciousness. It's a way of, it's one of the many ways that we human beings can, in a non-harmful way, explore and expand our consciousness. So I see this as a very crucial moment. And maybe the pandemic is a part of the story too, because it's forcing so many of us, as Sinead had just mentioned before we got together here, about so many people have had the opportunity to look into themselves more intimately, being forced to stay home and reflect and meditate on their own lives and inner space more readily. So anyway, that's a quick sense of where I'm coming from, in terms of my enthusiasm about the question that you asked.
Are you doing an article in their upcoming books? They've got two more books coming out. Are you contributing articles? And what's your sort of expertise that they're tapping into?
Oh, and are you talking about the Ray's books?
Yeah, the new books. They're coming out with two new volumes.
Well, yes. They sort of wrote me into reading about 85 documents. 85. By the time I finished reading these 85 documents, honestly, I was in a very peculiar state of mind. I mean, you cannot just take so much weirdness and not react, you know? But yes, I already had written one chapter, which will be in the first book. And Ray is cool about, I mean, I can write another three for him, but I'm working on so many different things. I'm content to have the one chapter, and I did a lot of what he asked me to do was to sort out these 85 papers and try to classify them, those that are publishable and readable. And I found about half of them unreadable and unpublishable. But many of them, some of the experiences were brilliant. and some of the theoreticians were brilliant, but there's a lot of need for editing, and I'm not doing that because I'm doing my own stuff, but but he's working on that. And so I think I was a help.
Yeah.
So I'll get my name on that book too.
It's sometimes kind of hard to keep up with Ray. He doesn't really sleep too much. He's sort of like the ever-ready battery, ready money.
Yeah, he got sick. His whole family was ill with the pandemic.
Yeah.
But he seems to have recovered. And yeah, he's a very high energy guy, and I like him a lot. And
go ahead, Sinead.
Thanks, Grant. Well, Michael, I just want to thank you for, on a personal level, but I think this also needs to be recognized, what you brought up about animals and their consciousness and how we're finally starting to realize that they have more conscious depth than we ever gave them credit for, because I really appreciate that personally. And I think that that's something that we should be considering as we enter into what many of us feel are, a global shift in consciousness and lots of opportunity, new opportunity, even though it may come with a great deal of challenge or suffering, to reevaluate, how are we living? How are we thinking? How are we feeling? And how are we living, thinking, and feeling in terms of other living beings that are around us? And, animals are treated as objects. That's the way that we treat them. Even if we have them as pets, we often don't see that they have their own consciousness and think, thoughts and feelings. So, I find it really fascinating, and maybe you can speak to this, how many people, myself included, as soon as we have our awakening or we come into an awareness of greater consciousness and UFOs, ETs, whatever it might be, that we can no longer eat animals, that's quite a common story, right? So that happened to me.
Oh, yeah. I confess I do eat fish. That's it. Twice a week I have a piece of fish. Recently, I was seeing something online and noticed a picture of a pig factory, and it was the most horrifying sight. Pigs are highly intelligent creatures, and they have feelings, and they were stuck in these little boxes and just like growing like pods, just to be shifted after their whole lives they don't have a life. They are just part of a manufacturing system. It was horrifying to watch this thing. And so yes, it has effect, but the business about animals is not just animals, it's the whole of living nature that we have wreaked havoc on for reasons.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I'm certainly not here to, push veganism or push vegetarianism. I think everybody needs to make their own choices, and it's not helpful to go around telling other people how you think that they should live. But it still ties into the interconnectedness of everything and the fact that consciousness exists in everything, right, including animals. So I just like that you took it there, because a lot of people don't involve plants or animals as being conscious beings. When we have these conversations, we typically just talk about ourselves as members of the human race, and as if that's where it ends. So can you talk a bit more to maybe how you feel we can change our ways of thinking or being right now in the way that we're living now? But you used COVID a little while ago as an example, the fact that we've all been forced to stay at home more than we usually would, that it's an opportunity for us to reflect and kind of take stock on our lives and how we're living. So this is an opportunity for us to think more about the interconnectedness of everything, how we all affect each other and how we can work together more, right? So do you have anything to say about that
There's one thought I would say is that, in my map of the picture of the potential mind that we can all become, the fully evolved mind, and consciousness and heart, if you will, that is potentially there for all of us. I'm particularly interested in telepathy because of its implications for empathy. Empathy is an extreme form of telepathy. And if you have some measure of telepathy, you can feel the inside of other people, other animals, and even inanimate nature. In fact, I've been tempted to write maybe a post or even a book about animism. Animism is supposed to be the most primitive form of philosophy and way of looking at the world. But the more consciousness we possess, the more animistic we become in effect. And when I'm in a high state of consciousness, everything looks alive to me. Mm. When I'm happy, when I'm in love, and I'm always in love with something, because someone recently on an interview ended my interview, what's love? And I'm like, oh, I didn't expect to be asked such a question. What is the meaning of love? So the thing I said, all I could think of was saying, without it, you're dead, you know? And of course, I don't mean just personal love. My idea, my experience is, as long as you're in love with something, it could be stamp collecting, I don't care what it is, it takes you out of yourself, mm-hmm. and you're a different human being. But without love, you're all wrapped up in yourself, and that's an unfortunate arrangement. So how can we induce greater telepathy and empathy in the world around us? That's a separate question. And I have a feeling it's what's required there is more stories and not pure science. And I mean, what changes people, I think, are stories, not facts, not bare information. It's important stuff. I accept that the role of science in this movement toward this new consciousness that we're talking about. But what we need are stories that touch us. And so, and that, I think that a lot of that is happening. Just the example of this recent case of I'm blacking out on his name because it's totally the man who was murdered 9 minutes. I've forgotten his name now. I'm putting it out, but that caused a major sort of transformation of consciousness all over the world, watching that man slowly being murdered by the police. So images and stories that reveal the inner realities is one way, one crucial and needed way to advance the creative evolution of our conscious life.
Michael, you are probably famous for the stories you tell. I think the one you'll go down in history as telling the best one is The Man Who Could Fly. And I'd like you to tell it for Sinead, because Sinead and I actually did an interview a couple months ago with a group. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this Mission Rama group. It's a Latino contactee group out of South America. And they had an event happen last August in which 9 witnesses were sitting 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of a field. Ended up in sort of like a portal Zendra type thing. There was hundreds of etheric beings around them, and they were levitated into the air for as much as 2 hours. So maybe you can tell your story. I think you've got the most the best recall of the levitation thing. And I want to ask you about the research you did. There's a guy from NASA who actually went to the he's an engineer at NASA. I don't know if you know the story, but he actually went to the Vatican Library to look at the files of the monk, to look at technological stuff. And there's something about the look on his face when he levitated, and they were looking to see if there's any technology that could be resolved from this guy that was levitating many, many centuries ago. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that is probably your most famous story, the work you did there.
Well, yeah, Joseph of Cupertino is a 17th century. He was born 1603 and died 60 years later. But Joseph is, the reason I focused on Joseph, and I made use of all those documents. I know about this person and his collection of that material. But I decided after an experiment that I performed in which I directed the levitation of a 200-pound ex-Marine up into the air at the mere touch, the finger with 4 young ladies in the classroom, just touching him. And I won't go into that detail story. But after doing that, and I myself saw with my own eyes that levitation was a reality. I then decided to do the research on Joseph Cupertino. I happened to know Italian, so I was able to get the documents in the original language. And Joseph, the amazing thing about Joseph is that for 35 years, while he was a priest, the levitations began only when he became a priest. It was as though, okay, now I have the right, I can do this. It's official, I'm a priest or whatever. But he was, in all the cases, there are about at least 150 recorded cases just in the Catholic Church alone, accounts of levitation of different saints. But by far, Joseph's is the most incredible. The things that I learned about levitation from Joseph, that it's all has to do with ecstasy, with a particular state of mind. And ecstasy is, you know, ekstasis in Greek means standing outside of yourself. And, you know, we've all had touches of ecstasy where we were so out of it that we forget ourselves. But the mystics, not just a Catholic, but the Buddhist also, there are records of Buddhist levitations at great length. But the state of mind that seems to lend itself to the manifestation of not only anti-gravitational forces, whatever that force is, but all kinds of unusual effects. It seems to be related to ecstasy. Now, why is that so? I think it's a fairly simple. Now, this may be a somewhat mechanistic metaphor, but it's not mechanistic. When we're ecstatic, we're out of ourselves. So the content of our everyday mind, the clutter, the emotions, the hesitations, the doubts, the ordinary state of mind that we're living our lives, all of those properties and values are temporarily wiped out. And it seems to me in that sort of state of emptiness, there's room for the great mind, the spiritual reality that pervades our existence, according to my understanding and many others, has the opportunity then to just enter our being. So in our normal, the reason why you're probably not going to levitate while you're in a supermarket trying to follow your list of things you have to buy is your mind is cluttered. And there's not enough room, not enough space to become sensitive to what may be all poised and ready to flow into your consciousness. So that is the key in my estimation for understanding not only levitation, but a host of paranormal phenomena. Because if you are a mystic, if you are a yogi or a shaman or a medium, and you're constantly practicing getting out of yourself, getting into that state of consciousness, I think that's sort of the background for understanding how these things come about. But it's also a model that we can test ourselves. I mean, if it's true, curiously, I received a letter from a gentleman who read my books, and he wants to learn how to levitate. And he's actually a martial artist and actually grew up in a very prayerful family. So he's already got something going for him. So I said, well, that's quite a wonderful challenge and I'll try to help you. But I said, what it really entails is practice in ecstasy and practice in really changing your life. And remember, the great saints tend to do things that ordinary people don't do, like fasting. I mean, why should fasting make a difference? Well, it weakens your body. You're less absorbed in the vital flow of existence and become more open to this power. What about sex? I mean, well, I think the erotic is a very interesting element because most of the saints try, at any rate, or appear to try to free themselves from their sexual needs and urges. If that's the case, they're probably mobilizing that energy also as part of the process of opening up. As a matter of fact, I mean, Joseph is what's dominated by one thing, his idea of love. I mean, and the great Saint Teresa is another great levitator, by the way, and a great lover. So this love and ecstasy and a transformation of our bodily and emotional habits, we have enough information there to begin to experiment if we're interested. Now, not everybody's going to want to do this, right? But I think that we do have, we're learning. If we, the more I have studied these phenomena and the conditions that give rise to them, the more I see it, it's up to me if I want to pursue this adventure radically and deeply myself. I am in some ways, but I'm no Saint Joseph of Cupertino, I can tell you that. but I think we can begin to form a model of how to generally enhance our receptivity to a wide range of phenomena and capacities that a lot of mainstream thinkers don't even believe are real. But I'm pretty confident that they are. But anyway, that's just some quick comments there about levitation and Saint Joseph.
The Roman Catholics have quite a history of this. They document it quite well. Did you ever work on the Shroud of Turin? Did you do on that kind of stuff?
And yeah,
can you talk a little bit about some of the other miracles, because it seems like maybe it's the prayer, the ritual, or whatever that people, monks go through, almost like Eastern, say, monks that would be able to do certain things, this disassociation thing. So
Exactly. Yeah. It's the same. I mean, whether it's yoga or shamanism, the shamans do it differently, but I mean, the vision quest of the native Indians of society is really, you go out and you spend days by yourself. You don't eat, you don't drink, you're all alone. Well, that's what Joseph did all the time. That's what except that Catholic saints have done it in the context of a highly organized church with a tradition and so forth. So I think these features that I've uncovered, and it's not just me that has studied these things, obviously, but I think we can begin to formulate a model that applies to all human behavior. And by the way, you don't have to be a monk or even religious to have these extraordinary experiences. What I have noticed is that they often occur when you're in danger. For example, I have cases of people that wrote me and told me about how they, gravity was suspended one person in particular, I'll mention his story. This was a guy that was on a speedboat or something and he fell off the boat. And he was about to plunge to his death because he would have gone under this boat and got, you know, whatever, underneath there, hacked to bits. But as he was falling, he was suspended. And the people in that boat saw it. He was suspended in space just long enough to grab a rope and save himself. Now, that doesn't happen to people who have, you know, near-death experiences all of the time. But he was quite certain, and he had witnesses to observe the fact. So sometimes in spontaneous circumstances, something happens which stymies temporarily the effect of the most fundamental force in physical nature, which is gravity. And I find that quite interesting. And then there's another area that really intrigues me, is that there are games that children play called Light as a Feather that entail levitation. I've been reading it. If you look it up on the line, there's lots of information about it. And that is the fact, that's what led to my experiment in my class. One of my students said, hey, when we were kids, we used to sit around and play a game called Light as a Feather. And we would touch each other and then say rise or something. They went through little rituals. And so I said, let's do it right now, because this was a class dedicated to mental evolution, so to speak. And without detailing, because it would take too long, but in effect, we succeeded in, I started mentioning this, in levitating this huge guy. And just recently, I read a similar story that goes back to the 17th century, and the English writer Samuel Pepys writes about the game that we call light as a feather was practiced then. And he describes a case that he witnessed. By the way, he's a fine writer, Samuel Pepys. Four children, little children, who could barely understand English. One of them in particular was just a little child, who touched, and it was emphasized, a fat, heavy man, and raised him up just by touching him. And it's almost exactly analogous to what I experienced, because I had the four ladies. They were not children, but they were just barely, they couldn't possibly lift a 200-pound guy up in the air. I think you'd need five people to do that. It would be visible that you're making an effort. But I was there, I watched, there was no effort. They just raised their arms and up he went. And I'll tell you one thing I remember, the look of utter astonishment on that guy's face. He was an ex-Marine. And I can see it right now. It's in my mind's eye. An astonishing, he was both terrified and ecstatic at the same time. But I'm really fascinated by the mystery here of levitation
Can I ask one more question before I go to Sinead? I'm going to cut Sinead off because this applies. The light as a feather, I used to do that. I used to give UFO lectures back in the 70s when I first started. Oh. And I would do this in schools with kids. Uh-huh. And I would show them this thing. And I remember I did it with my father. Remember the old TVs? My father used to build TVs. He was sort of electrical hobby guy. And he'd build these old Heathkit TVs that were, you know, huge wooden TVs and stuff. And I remember we did it one time with him with the TV, and TV must have weighed 200 pounds. And my father was skeptical, but he was, you know, he had a lot of questions. And I remember the same thing you described, like the look on his face. Uh-huh. So the question I have for you is, why do you think these kind of things don't take off? You'd figure like you'd have stuff like this is going on and everybody would just jump on the bandwagon. And yet you get people who they see it and they go, yeah, okay. And they just go on with their life as if nothing happened. It's kind of weird.
Well, you just asked me a question that I've been thinking about, because I am baffled and amazed at how quickly people forget the most extraordinary things and how obsessively they babble on about the most trivial stuff in the world. Now, I'll give you an example. In 1995, there was this mass miracle all over India of milk dematerialization phenomena. You know, you must know that story.
I heard you tell that story. Yeah.
Well, I watched it on CNN. I watched the reporter hold a little cup of milk in front of a statue of Ganesha, the remover of obstacles. He did it with this, and I watched the milk slowly disappear. And again, the astonishment on the face of that reporter was something. Then I'll just add this one detail. I had two Indian students who did this. They were there in front of a temple, and one of them wrote up a detailed paper. He said he went online three times to convince himself. Each time he succeeded. He brought the milk up and it disappeared. I think I mentioned it in my book on miracles. I have a discussion of that. But and now that happened. Now, the scientists, in quotes, came up with some truly stupid attempt to explain it away. Truly stupid. I'm not even going to describe it. But the overwhelming majority of sane, honest people saw what was happening. But within a few days, it was forgotten. That nobody in America knows about it. Although apparently it was announced by Indian religious people that it was the greatest miracle in a millennium. And there was a mass, reconversions back to religion, apparently. but I haven't heard much. Of course, I'm not in India, and I'm sure I'm missing. There must be stuff out there. But I am really amazed at the superficiality of people, that in a way they forget the extraordinary and dwell on the trivial. I think that just, I don't get it.
Michael, you didn't hear me because I was muted, but I laughed out loud when you said that it's kind of baffling how quick people are to forget the most extraordinary things, and how quick we are also to focus on things that just really don't mean anything at all. So that is so true. I mean, for example, Grant has told me many, many times about when he first witnessed his first ever UFO flap, you know, called Charlie Red Star, back in the 70s, and there were hundreds of people witnessing this, and several of them were people that he knew personally that were friends of his, but he's the only one whose life was completely changed, and, you know, changed the trajectory of his life, and he made completely different choices as a result. And here we are, you know, talking to him now, whereas there are still friends that he knows now that were with him then and witnessed the same thing, and they just have no interest in talking about it, thinking about it. That baffles me as well. I don't understand that at all, but of course there's a reason. There is a reason for all of these things, right? There's a reason why it affects some of us and doesn't affect others. So kind of touching on that, touching on perspective, I just want to go back for a minute to what you were saying earlier. You've made a few references through our conversation about the value and importance of getting out of ourselves in some way, you know, meditation, fasting, mysticism, whatever it might be, having a stamp.
Art.
That's
so my way. Painting, I'm out of this world, you know?
Yes. So something that's going to help us transcend, help us get out of our own perspective a little bit. So all of that is incredibly valuable in terms of giving ourselves even tiny little opportunities to join the kind of collective mind, right, or to be able to tap in. So having said that, to flip that upside down for a minute and focus on the self, what do you think is the purpose of the self? You know, why is it that these experiences, when we leave ourselves, when we get out of our ego, you know, through psychedelics and art, anything, any of the things we've just listed, we try to leave our ego behind, we try to give ourselves, or we just happen to have a transcendent experience. That is what helps us learn more, grow more, go further, you know, in our mind. So what is the purpose of having a self? Why are we all individuals here? What do you think?
Very easy to answer that. We're encased in bodies, and we have to protect those bodies. And because without them, we're going to suffer and die or whatever. I mean, the fact that, I believe that our personal consciousness is linked to a greater consciousness, but we don't have that greater awareness because we are wrapped up in one body and one history, one culture, one family. We're confined. And it's perfectly natural. I mean, on the one hand, you know, we're sort of, we're living in two worlds. I mean, the world of the mind, which I perceive as and understand to be infinite, boundless. I have a blog called Consciousness Unbound. That's not true for our bodies. And our experience, and our experience is bound to the time, the place, parents, genetics, the experiences we've had, if we've been wounded. I was just reading recently something that I already knew, but I liked seeing it read, about how parents really can wreak havoc on their children. If they say the wrong things, do the wrong thing. I was very lucky. I had parents my mom, I always had books lying around the house about the saints because my mom was into that, not my father. He was pretty detached and he was not into religion at all, but my mother was, and she had all these books lying around. But nobody ever, you know, I was the first one to go to college to think of going to school, to college. And my parents didn't know anything about it. They were not literate. They were barely literate, my parents. And they said, is that a good thing? And I said, yeah. So they helped me, you know. I mean, they didn't have much money, but so I was lucky. And I think that's a lot of that, that's crucial in terms of what kind of a person you evolve into. On the other hand, sometimes being wounded can open you up in surprising ways. But I was lucky, and I had a brother who was educated, became a violinist and all of that, and he, an older brother, then he dumped books in my lap and all of that. So yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if maybe I've strayed away from the question that you posed.
Well, no, I don't think you have. I mean, I feel like you're illustrating a lot of different ways in which having an individual body and an individual experience and individual identity, you know, there's so many tools within that, right? That the body is a tool, the experience is a tool, but then we might not always be able to see it that way, of course, right? We have to have a certain amount of ability and willingness to look at ourselves and self-reflect and learn from that. We might not even know how to do that in any given lifetime. So do you believe in reincarnation? Do you think that, do you think consciousness comes back into bodies multiple times? Or
well, yeah, my colleague at DOPS, yeah, the Division of Personality Studies at University of Virginia, and Ian Stevenson is probably the most famous modern investigator of reincarnation memories, and I've read their books and the material, and it's compelling. I don't know and don't necessarily believe that everybody is reincarnated. And there's other, you know, there are other evidences for life after death besides reincarnation, all kinds of mediumship, certain types of out of body experiences, apparitions of the dead, all kinds of forms. I myself, if I had my druthers, will not come back. I want to keep going into new worlds, you see. I don't want to come back to, I think the idea of reincarnation is sort of awful in a way. You die and you come back and you're like a baby, you're starting all over again. So maybe there's all that stuff is just latent in you, all the marvelous things you learned and achieved in your life and your previous lives, but you gotta work like hell to get at it, if at all. So the idea of reincarnation strikes me as punishment. And I think that's pretty much what the Eastern idea is.
Yeah.
Back in the 1980s, I was friends with Swami Nada Brahmananda, who's a rare master of Nada Yoga, sound yoga. And he always used to say, Michael, he says, watch out, you're going to come back for 30,000 more reincarnations if you don't watch out. I mean, I was like a joke he would say to keep me alert. And so anyway, that's my view. It's not maybe a lot of, I hear a lot of people talk about reincarnation as though it's a wonderful thing. I don't get it. I don't want to be reincarnated. Sorry.
That makes a lot of sense. I really like your sort of direct honesty about it. And it's also interesting. I mean, if reincarnation really is a thing, because of course we don't have any actual so-called proof that it is a thing.
But well, we do have strong evidence from which we may infer that it's a fact of nature. I do believe that.
I agree with you. I should rephrase. Proof that is widely accepted in the media.
That's it.
Right? That has not happened. But I love that we, you know, the conversation about it continues to expand. And I love that also we're no longer talking about reincarnation. I think, you know, all this time we've been talking about it as being a kind of earthbound situation, but as we expand our understanding more and more of space, and we learn even just through science, you know, we learn more and more of the fact that there are many, many, many inhabitable planets and galaxies out there. The universe continues to be more enormous than we ever thought it could possibly be. And, you know, maybe reincarnation doesn't only happen on Earth. We don't just keep coming back to the same planet over and over again. We might get reincarnated to another planet or another galaxy. Like, who knows how it's all working? Right. That's why it's so fun to have these conversations.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm open to the idea that this is a reality. And as far as the vastness of the universe and all that, we still don't have evidence of life anywhere else in the universe but on this planet, right? They're hoping to find signs of some maybe microbial life on Mars. I mean, obviously Mars is not full of you know, elephants and things that, you know, all kinds of animals. But So I don't know that I'm not. I'm more interested in exploring the mind than inner space than outer space. Mm-hmm. But it's an instinct to want to travel and explore the universe in whatever way we can do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the mind certainly allows us to travel, doesn't it? Right? Skills, we can travel anywhere we want to go. We just have to know how to do it. We don't necessarily have to get in a rocket ship with Elon Musk and fly ourselves up to somewhere else. We can travel anytime we want to if we are able to. We take the time.
And we could use a psychedelic rocket ship to get us someplace interesting too. I mean, I'm a strong believer in the utility. I mean, and religious traditions are full of, you know, the Eleusinian mystery cult in ancient Greece lasted for 2,000 years until some Catholic emperor said, no more, you can't do that anymore. But for 2,000 years, the ancient Greeks had this annual celebration of the goddess Persephone, the goddess of the underworld. And we now know that the peak of the ritual, after 9 days of fasting, that's going to alter your consciousness, then they would drop the koukion, which in Greek simply means the brew. And the brew, apparently, according to the people who have investigated this, was some kind of a mixture of, dig this, beer and LSD. And then they had the climactic vision that many of the great Greek poets and philosophers went through, and it changed them. It altered their lives. So, yeah, I think that's one way of getting out of yourself.
Definitely. And Michael, maybe if I can grab an opportunity with you right now. Sure. Grant and I have done several interviews about psychedelics, and we both have learned a great deal about the value of journeying that way and traveling that way, how much it can benefit a person in so many different ways, which science and the medical fields are now getting into as well, because they're discovering the value too. Mm-hmm. But often many people do understand what we're talking about and what other people in the field are talking about with regard to psychedelics, but a lot of people still see them as being drugs, and they're dangerous, and they can make you psychotic, and they can ruin your life. So my perspective and Grant's perspective is that psychedelics are not drugs. Like, psychedelics are plant medicines. There's a whole process. You have to honor the plant. You have to honor the process. You can't just take them and go to a party. You know, that's not going to happen. Could you speak a little bit to that language, you know, that we're so used to using when it comes to psychedelics and marijuana, that they are drugs, that therefore they're bad. It's on the same level as heroin, cocaine, and, you know, over-the-counter medications, that kind of thing, when in fact they are really not. Would you mind speaking to that a bit?
Not at all. In fact, I think the point that you make is very much bigger than just drugs. I think that we can say that some of the most important changes come about when we change the language. You're absolutely right, and I appreciate that what you just said. I'm going to try to do that myself. I mean, the way everyone knows what you mean when you say drug, right? But you're absolutely right. The language, if you phrase it, if you use the wrong language, you already set the mind in the wrong direction, and you can induce expectations that could then be acted out.
Fears and apprehensions.
Absolutely. So I completely agree with you. And I've been thinking about how language is, I'm constantly trying. For example, I talk a lot about the paranormal, and I write a lot about it. And I keep tending to not want to use that language at all, and just talk about extraordinary human experiences, extensions of the mind. In other words, tell a story in fresh, specific language that's highly descriptive, but without any technical verbiage or terminology that has connotations that's going to turn your listener or your reader off. So that's a real challenge. And that point that you made is absolutely central to some of my thinking of late. So I appreciate what you just said. And thank you for the hint about how to phrase.
Well, thank you. You inspired me to say it.
Well, that's what happens when we have a good conversation, right?
I think Grant probably wants to join in. I've been hogging a little bit. Grant, do you have something you want to say about maybe psychedelics, actually?
Yeah, we're getting close to the hour, but I want to go because Michael's written a lot about extraordinary experiences, miracles, whatever term we want to use for it. Can you tell me about the one that you witnessed with the statue, the tears and the statue? And can you go to of a guy who's written for so many years about extraordinary experiences? What is the biggest experience you've had in your life?
I'll begin with the first, the second thing that you asked me, my own experience. The most striking experience, and I've had precognition and psychokinetic experiences that are very powerful, but my UFO encounter in 1971, which I mentioned earlier, is the most striking. And I'll tell you why. Something completely outside of myself that manifested as light, moving light, knew on that night of April 23rd, 1971, 5 days after my, or before, I've got to look it up, I've forgotten, my PhD, it knew what we were doing inside. There I am with my girlfriend, Jane, and I, and it was her birthday. I was sort of celebrating my PhD imminent.
Yep.
And we're listening to The Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost by John Coltrane. You know Coltrane's music.
Yeah.
Wild stuff. And wild, intense jazz, okay? But with a religious title. And so I step out I get off the couch at about 11:30. I just reread the story. I've written it up in one of my books. I remember some of the details more. And I go to the window at 11:30 at night, look out the window, and I'm kind of listening to the music and going along grooving with my feet, and suddenly a cluster of lights appears out of nowhere and seems to be dancing in unison with the music and with me. And I see a human face superimposed on of that, or not just a face, a body, of an ordinary human being smiling and sort of grooving with me as if, yeah, we get it. And then that lasted about, I don't know, 10 seconds, 20 seconds. In the meantime, I got Jane to come to the window. She saw the same thing. And then the lights, after we got our treatment of the lights dancing in front of us, they shot north about a block because I was living in Greenwich Village, to the Dome of Our Lady of Pompeii, a Catholic church.
Okay.
We're listening to Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. It's a cat, and the lights perch on top of that, of the dome of that church, and beam at us. And then his part I forgot until I reread it. Then it came back and they danced in front of us again. And then they took off going north, and we switched to the window facing north, because I was right on the corner. And in a nanosecond, those lights in the classic UFO pattern zigzagged over the Empire State Building and vanished. We went up the roof because we were living on the sixth floor. Well, and first we went back and, well, we were in the house and we felt sort of, it was electric. And I said, let's go up the roof. I don't know why I said that, because when we went up the roof, there was a third person, a guy named Louis, whom I had just recently turned on to John Coltrane's music.
Okay.
He's a young drummer. And the first thing he says, did you see that? Three of us witnessed this, okay? And, you know, every time years later, I would see Louis in the village, every time I met him, we would both say the same thing. Have you seen any lights in the sky? You know, and sadly, I'm out of touch with Jane, who was heaven for me in those days. And I've tried to get in touch with her. I know she moved back out west and I couldn't track her down. But that was certainly one of the most striking experiences of my life, because how did they know there's something out there? I mean, you call it the Holy Ghost. It's a spirit. It's an energy form that knew what we were doing.
Now let me ask a question off that.
Sure.
Before you get to the weeping statue. I mean, that's the question I always have with experiencers. When I talk to experiencers, I always say to them, do you think you're on a mission? And they go, yeah, I think so, but I don't know what it is. And so that's the question is, when you go back, we used to think back in 1975, and probably the same with you, when you see a UFO in 1971, as you did in 1975, as I did, that was a random event. You just happened to be in the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the right time, time. And then once the abduction scenario started coming in and people were regressed, they would think they had this event when they were like 40 years old. And they say, is that the first time you saw it? No. And it would go right back to birth. So the question is, how much of what it is, how much of our life is random? Were you picked to play this role? Were you woken up, sent down the rabbit hole to do what you're doing?
That's an interesting question, and I often am puzzled. I ask myself, why have I experienced, by the way, that was the only UFO encounter.
Okay.
But I have had all these other experiences since I was a kid. I remember my first ESP experience, I was about 8 years old.
Yeah.
And I've continued until very recently. I had a very unusual experience. So I've been asking myself, why have I had psychokinetic. I've had experiences that are weird and they're sort of, they're hard to even to describe, but I can go on and on talking about them. So I ask myself, why me? And I don't have this sense of a mission. That's a little too grandiose for my sensibility, but I do have a very clear sense that I've been instructed. That, in other words, I haven't been converted into a powerful psychic who can do things on command or on demand and demonstrate to the world I'm such a great guy. Rather, I've had these totally unexpected flashes of marvelous experience. And I think the whole point of them all is to wake me up and to know that I'm in a universe that's full of mystery. And I then have been driven by sheer curiosity and the need to figure out what happened to me to pursue this, to write books, to give talks, to do this, what I'm doing with you right now. So I want to call that a mission. Yeah, it gives my life a sense of purpose. I suppose if I drop dead tomorrow, I'll be remembered as a guy who wrote a couple of books about this stuff. So in that sense, you know, yes. But I don't wake up in the morning and feel swollen with pride that I've been chosen.
No. But there does seem to be a pattern. Like the other thing is I'll ask people, they'll say, I don't think I've really been abducted. I just have these dreams of these beings. And then I say, anything else weird happened in your life? They go, oh yeah. And they start telling you about this and that. 39% of all experiencers in the free survey that Ray Hernandez and Edgar Mitchell did had near-death experiences. Like that's eight times the national average. 80% have had out-of-body experiences. 50% believe they can heal people. 50% they've said they've been healed. And then you look at the near-death experience literature, it's even worse. It's like 70% of people with near-death experiences believe they can heal people. And 40% of all experiencers say at one point during their experience, they knew the answer to everything in the universe. If you look at the near-death experience people, they say 31% said at one point during my experience, I knew the answer to everything in the universe. And you start seeing these things where they're not these random events. They're these events where the person doesn't really realize all these things are connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let me comment on the knowing everything business, because I keep running into people who have that attitude. But William James talked about the noetic experience.
Yep.
And I think that's a little different. And that makes sense to me. The noetic sense means that it's a feeling. It's not a cognition that I know that the answers to everything. I'm going to explain black holes and blah, blah, blah. Yep. I have a totally perfect theory of psi and all that.
Yeah, but it's not people. It's not that people remember it. It's just to say at one point in their experience, they believe they had. And that's not something you'd make up. That's what I found it significant. Is you're going to say I had a near-death experience. You're not going to stick in the fact that you knew everything in the universe. It doesn't make any sense. But right. It's just for one moment. And they forgot. They said, I'll remember this when I go back. And the and whatever says, no, you're not going to remember. And when they come back, they don't remember anything. They just remember that they think that at one point they or they knew everything about themselves, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, that I can understand. That makes sense. And that you have a glimpse of the vastness of the world that you inhabit, that you're inhabiting. So,
or the noetic, you're talking about William James, the noetic thing where, and I've had these experiences. That's what happened to me in 2012, where it wasn't a good idea. It was like, I was talking to God. It was like, this is the way it works. And there is no doubt about this. That's that noetic thing. It comes with like absolute knowledge. This is not, you know, and that's the weird sort of thing that I think I feel honored. I don't know about you, but in terms of being able to deal with this, you know, most people are watching football games and they're doing ordinary things or whatever. We're living in this almost like a Disneyland of spectacular things that you know, you have this entertainment every day of realizing how magnificent the universe is and how complex it is.
Absolutely. You know, people talk about being lonely during this period of sequestration. I've been crowded with all of the ideas, and the books, just reading the books and the experiences and remembering. I agree with that. But anyway, did you want me to comment on that miracle of the that story?
Yeah, because that was something that you actually witnessed. So a lot of people will hear story, but you're actually one of the ones that actually went down there and checked it out and can confirm, yeah, that was exactly what people are saying, which is what I find. You hear people's stories, and you say, well, I don't know if I really believe them. But then when you go there and then you realize, like most people, they're just telling you what they actually saw. And it's just very weird. But you were an actual witness to this paranormal event.
Yes, I remember watching on television. I think it was 1994. I think that's the correct date. I noticed on television a report of a miracle taking place in a Greek Orthodox church in Astoria, New York. It turns out that's where I was born, and I was living in the village at that time, I think. So I said, "Oh, I'm going to take a ride into Astoria and see what's going on there." So I went to the church, and I got online, and I was finally able to confront this. It was an icon in some kind of wooden case. And I got online, and I was able to go right up in front of it. And it was, I could see the tears coming out of the area where the eyes were. And it was quite clear what they were. And that it was liquid tears, or looked like tears. I don't know if they actually did a test to see if it was. I asked there was an Orthodox priest standing there, and I asked him about that. And he said, we haven't done that yet, but we have a history with this icon. In the past, it has done all kinds of strange things. And so he led me to believe that there was scientifically investigated. But I know it has been in other instances. Yes, but I saw this. I came back a second day, by the way, with a colleague of mine. We both saw it again. You know, eyewitness testimony is hard to dismiss. I couldn't resist the opportunity to see that with my own eyes.
I'll send it back to Sinead, but your experience is the same as mine, is the eyewitness, because my first sighting, I had no intention of ever, never thought about UFOs or whatever. There was just a small town that was seeing these objects. And I said to my friend, instead of driving around the big city, why don't we just go out and see what they're looking at? I had no intention. And I was the idea. I was like, you buy the lottery ticket, you think you're going to win, but or that you have a chance to win, but you're not going to win. You're not going to see anything. Mm-hmm. I went out and I was just floored when I saw it. I went, there is actually miracles. And I remember that because I was raised very religiously. Uh-huh. And it was like, there are no miracles. They may have been in the Bible, but there are no miracles anymore. And when I saw that, it was like, oh my God, there are miracles. Like, what is going on here? It's people don't realize how it can sort of throw you off the cliff where you got nothing to support you. And you realize like, wow, the world is completely different than what I thought was going on.
Absolutely. And by the way, that business about miracles only in the biblical times, that was the cornerstone of the Protestant Reformation. And it, in part, it was designed to keep the Catholics in their place. Really, that's what. And so between Protestantism, and which gave birth to capitalism, and modern science, we've cultivated an attitude of suspicion, or in modern America and the world, that's doubts the reality of miracles. Whereas the church itself, the Catholic Church, you know, it may have some difficulties there, but it has retained the belief that these things are always possible. I mean, why should God suddenly say, "Hey, I've had enough of making miracles. It's a bore now. I'm gonna leave the human race by itself. No more miracles." Good. It doesn't make any sense. You know?
Exactly.
If that's where the miracles are coming from, that's just a, I don't know where, how to explain these phenomena, but that's the, would be the religious interpretation.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, speaking of religion, which I know is fascinating for you, Michael, because you're not attached to religion, but you see it as a way in which these miracles are expressed and, you know, a tool that people can use to transcend themselves and so many other things, yeah, advancing their spirituality. One of my favorite stories is Our Lady of Guadalupe. I just absolutely love that story. I think it's incredible. The evidence is incredible. The story itself is incredible. But, you know, we really do get very attached to these labels of this God is the right one because of miracles, right? Because miracles that happen in Catholicism mean that the Catholic God is therefore the right God.
Right. No, I'm not saying that, right.
Yeah. And so it just made me, it reminded me of what you said just a few minutes ago, which I very much related to, about your own attitude, you know, that it's about that these things that you've experienced, these amazing things that you've experienced, they've woken up your curiosity and your awareness that you are part of the universe, and that your curiosity is the driving force to, you know, motivate you to explore it and to just enjoy that exploration. Kind of like that saying, you know, life is a journey, not a destination, or happiness is a journey, not a destination. So we really do get very, very attached to answers. We get very attached to certain words and certain terminology and certain labels, and we are unwilling or unable sometimes to let go of those particular things. And then they're very limiting because they don't allow us to see the actual message that's underneath all of that. So I just really appreciated that you said, you know, you feel like your own experiences have served the purpose of keeping you awake and aware as much as possible and keeping you curious. So as we round up the interview, because unfortunately we do have to do that, I think we could talk all day, but you know, we do have to wrap it up. What would you like to say to our audience? You know, what is something that you'd like to leave them with in terms of how you feel, what you feel you have to offer people who are listening to you right now as they go through their own lives, as they think about their own consciousness, as they think about the paranormal phenomena and miracles and magical things that we all witness through life? What would you like them to really be left with?
Well, you know, first of all, I want to comment on something that you said, that in terms of the effects on me of having these experiences, one of the major effects is that I've learned to respect other people who have stories even more fantastic than mine. So I can listen to your stories, and I'm open, and I love the idea of a community of people who have different, unusual, strange, even upsettingly weird experiences. So I'm open to all of that. And I would try to say to readers that to recommend that even if they have not had any striking experiences, that they might make an effort to keep their minds open. And actually, in the book that I wrote there, I give talk about some of the ways that we can make ourselves more receptive to the extraordinary. So there is that aim in my writing that so I get a lot of people, like I mentioned to you earlier, that been in touch with a young man who wants to learn how to levitate, and I'm all set to help him. And because, I mean, he sounds like a highly intelligent, he's married to a beautiful Asian woman, and he's a 30-year-old guy. He's done extraordinary things already, and now he wants to learn how to levitate. So, I'm enthusiastic, and I try to excite other people to think about these matters. But I have to say that it's amazing how many people, even very close to me, resist. I mean, dear friends and even family members look at me like they don't want to hear it, you see. So there's a limit. There are limits to what we can do. I think that if you're, we can do something to, we can help each other to a certain degree, but the individual has to be, take the inner step himself or herself, but we can maybe prod them on. I don't have any formulas for how to turn the world on. Not yet anyway.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Michael. So everyone who's listening right now, you heard it. Stay open, stay curious. And that's all you really need to do. Stay open, stay curious. Look for things that maybe pull you in a direction you might not have expected. Allow yourself to explore it, because why not? Right? Why not? There's nothing that tells us really that we can't at least entertain these ideas and just see where they're going to take us.
And we can be more than, we can do more than entertain them if we're really motivated. We can trigger the conditions that enable us. But that's the basis of another talk on another time.
Yes.
the details of that. Yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of chapters in here, that's for sure. So, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today and to share your experience and your knowledge. It really has been really and really enjoyable. And Grant, as always, thank you for letting me be here and for letting me participate in this wonderful conversation that we get to have with so many different people. It's really a pleasure. And Michael, really honored and appreciative to have you here today. Thank you so much.
Well, I thank both of you for the opportunity to talk and enjoy this conversation.
Okay, maybe one last question. What's your next project? Have you got a project coming up? We'll link your books and stuff, but what's your next big thing you're working on?
I'm working on about three different things. You know, I'm a painter. I have a sort of a nightlife as an artist, and I've decided that I want to try to get to make the contact, the interaction between painting and parapsychology. So, but I'm also working on a new book. I've been writing so many essays, I forget all the things that I've written. So I am planning to write or to publish, because I've written already a whole bunch of essays on this theme, you see, of the big mind. My books on Joseph were specific about a person. My next project is to write a wider scope, a kind of big picture of the whole history of this phenomenon of expanding consciousness. So that sounds kind of grandiose, but that's where I'm drifting toward.
Well, let us know when it's out, and we'll maybe do another interview and we can discuss that book.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sounds good.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was an honor to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.